So we'll get this started. Thank you very much for coming today. My name is Elizabeth Howell, and we are going to be doing a session here on e-publishing, e-books, as opposed to the more traditional route. So just a couple of notes before we get started. This session, as you can probably tell, is being recorded, and it's going to be put on the Canadian Science Writers Association website at a later date as a webinar. So just a couple notes with that. Because we are recording this, we're going to be asking that anybody who does questions go up to that microphone you can see in the center of the room. Beside the microphone on the chair, beside the lady in the green shirt, is a set of disclosure forms. If you could just quickly print your name, your address, and your email, I will sign the forms as you're leaving. And those are just to acknowledge that you are going to be willing to participate in this webinar and have your image recorded and your voice recorded, etc. And so now we shall get started. So it's hard to summarize the disruptive voice, the disruptive force of the internet on journalism in just a brief introduction, but surely we can speak of a lot of the same things, which is, of course, a rising opportunity for freelancers, as well as some of the worries from corporations about trying to keep up their revenues. So here today, let's just focus on the opportunity. And we have a couple of people here who are experts in this field. We're all readers, and we do know that the publishing industry is changing. And these two gentlemen here are going to be telling us all about that. So first, we're going to have Dr. Green, who is an internationally known organic chemist who's now at New York University. In science circles, he focuses on the three-dimensional nature of both small molecules and polymers. And I'm not really an expert in that field, but I did run a search of his name on a couple of websites, and a lot of his papers have been cited for hundreds of times. So obviously there is some influence there. And in addition to his science work, he also is a writer for a Cape Breton newspaper called Inverness Oran. I hope I said that right. Is that about right? Yeah? Okay. And also his personal website, Science From Away. And our second speaker will be Stephen Strauss, who most of you already know. He is the president of the Canadian Science Writers Association. He wrote about science at the Globe and Mail for 25 years, and he's now a freelance science journalist. There he was actually known at the Globe and Mail as Dr. DeBunco, and earned numerous awards and fellowships for his work. Anyway, thank you very much, and we will begin with Dr. Green.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to come to McGill, where two of my children, one still goes here and another graduated, but they have nothing to do with science. Maybe the grandchildren. At any rate, I want to tell you about an experience I had. When I reached my late 60s, around 70, I decided to close my laboratory and not do any and not take any more graduate students for doctoral degrees, and switched over to an old interest of mine, which was to present science for public consumption. And that led to the writing of columns for the Inverness Oran, which is a wonderful little weekly newspaper in Inverness, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, which you can find on the web. I recommend it. And Rankin MacDonald, the editor and publisher. And that was a lot of fun writing that. But I had an old idea about the way science was taught to undergraduate students in universities all over the world, in Canada, the United States, wherever. Generally, the way science is taught, and this, my specific knowledge is about organic chemistry, but it's generally true of all the sciences, is the opposite way from the way arts are taught. In the arts, generally, the work of art is presented, and then you deconstruct that to find out how was such a thing created. Listen to the symphony, hear the poem, whatever it may be. But in science, the students are forced to learn all the fundamental principles without any relevance or context. And then only much later on do they learn why these things are interesting or worth knowing. In organic chemistry, the educators get away with this because the students really know that they have to get through that course if they want to go to medical school or dental school. So they're sort of forced into accepting this really ridiculous way of teaching. And I had this idea really first in 1967 when I stood before my first lecture class, which is to present the subject backwards, or what could be called top-down learning. And that would be where you present some complex phenomenon and then pull the principles out of it that were necessary for its creation. And to teach the subject in that way. And that led to an earlier book that I wrote mainly for professors to have information of this type. And that book was published by Wiley, by the German arm of Wiley, called Wiley Verlag Chemie, Wiley VCH. It's a very large and very important textbook publisher. And I disliked what happened with that publication. First of all, I got them, they promised me that they'd sell the book for $25. It ended up the book costing $80. I've been under pressure from them to write new editions of the book. I said new editions are not necessary. I later learned why the publishers want all these new editions, because a friend of mine who teaches at the University of Manchester in England has a very highly regarded organic chemistry book, and I was there giving a talk about some of these things that I do about three-dimensionality and stuff, and we were going to go to the pub, and he said, well, we can't. I can't go with you tonight. Some of my colleagues are going to go, what's going on? Well, Oxford Press, who published his book, was putting him under pressure to have a new edition come out. It's been eight years since the early one. He said, the new edition is really not necessary, he told me. But they warned him that if he was unwilling to participate in the writing of the new edition, that they would find someone to write the new edition and put his name on it because they own the copyright. These kinds of experiences convinced me to self-publish this new book. And even though I was offered a few opportunities of a major publisher to publish it. So this was my primary reason for self-publication. Now, self-publication doesn't always arise from a reason like that. It used to be called vanity. They were called vanity press. People would self-publish things because they couldn't get a publisher to publish it. This was not the case in my case, but increasingly I'm finding a lot of people are self-publishing it. And when I was first thinking about this, I was in touch with a Nobel Prize winner at Harvard by the name of Elias J. Corey, who has a Nobel Prize in organic chemistry. And it turns out that Corey encouraged me to self-publish. He said, more and more people should be doing this because the publishing industry doesn't always have the best interest of the students at heart with regard to how much they charge and unnecessary extra editions. When I was I remember when I was an undergraduate student, I entered City College in New York, $7.50 a term, in 1954, when I was a freshman at City College. I remember when we went to take a course, you needed the textbook, you went to the used bookstore, and you bought the book that the kid in the year before you had bought and then sold back. And those books lasted for 10 or 15 years because the subject didn't change all that much. But nowadays, I can show you a typically highly used organic textbook that in a period of 12 years has gone through 8 editions. And this is not atypical, which means that the editions are really killing the used book market. And of course, no publisher will ever admit such a thing, but that's my analysis of it. You can jail me if you like, you know. But that's my analysis of it. I don't say it's the truth, but it's my analysis of it. So I wrote this book. And you can see that this is the self-published cover of the book, which I'll talk about in a moment. And these are the kinds of comments that the book received before publication, pre-publication comments. The University of Illinois, a creative and daring approach. And Ohio State University, David Hart. This is the most interesting organic textbook I have read since my days as an undergraduate. So the seen by my colleagues, this book was pretty interesting. Oh, what do I do? Which the? Oh, this one? Thank you. These are other comments that the manuscript received. Like no other textbook. And Ian Fleming was really funny. He's a famous organic chemist at Cambridge in the United Kingdom. And this is typically British. I think you've done something really interesting. Wow, thanks, Ian. This guy's a really bigwig, you know. But then in a typically British way, he says, so much so that I read it with much more care than I might have. In other words, I don't know you from Adam, Mark Green, and I would never look at anything you've done, you know. So that is sort of a British way, I think. And anyhow, then he compliments it. Marvelous, and from Holland, and Israel, a masterwork. You know, in other words, people like the book. When I was still struggling with the self-publishing idea, I wasn't sure which way to go, I did send it to a lot of publishers. And every, overwhelmingly, although I did get an offer from a few of them to publish the book, overwhelmingly, the book was declined in spite of these kinds of comments. And the reason for that is that I found that many large publishers don't want to risk publishing what amounts to a revolutionary new idea. They were afraid it wouldn't sell, the money they'd have to put into it would not be returned, and that's the message that I got. And so that's when I decided to self-publish the book. And so when the book came out, the publisher's expectations, in fact, turned out to be the case. The book came out in October of 2012, and I'll tell you shortly how that happened, how the self-publishing happened. And there was within a few months, a review appeared in Angewandte Chemie. That's useful chemistry. That's one of the two most important, or two or three most important, chemistry journals in the world. And this came from a professor, distinguished elderly professor at Braunschweig University, Henning Hopf. And these are some things that he wrote. "This is an interesting book. Thank you, Henning. Although not in the sense of the songs of praise by the many experts printed on the 4.5 pages of the book." This comment elicited many emails, including from the man from Cambridge in Ohio State, and who pointed out to me, "We're not experts, quote unquote. We are experts." So that immediately, this German professor caused consternation out in the community. And he said, "In the reviewer's opinion, Green has failed in his attempt or is forced to accept somebody." In other words, he didn't like the book. In fact, he hated the book. He said, "The book is interesting, but only if you already know organic chemistry. If you already know organic chemistry, then you may find the book interesting." In other words, he just absolutely trashed the book. But then, a few months later, a review came out in the chemistry part of Nature. That's Nature Chemistry. Nature is now broken up into different sections. So this is a fancy place. And the reviewer here said, "Instructors who scoff at Green's textbook based only on thumbing through will miss what he's attempting to accomplish. The philosophy is one of immersion, and each chapter is theme-based on an intriguing question or stimulating case study, and et cetera, et cetera." And he ends up by saying, "This textbook offers a fascinating and dramatic change to the landscape of textbook choice." Well, my wife, who's an artist, pointed out to me that the book, that 2013 is the 100-year anniversary of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, where people in the audience, I think, yelled and even threw tomatoes, rotten tomatoes, and because they were so upset. She said, "This is the demonstration that an idea is truly new." And in fact, there is a quote in the book about this by a fellow named Kettering, who was the Kettering of the Sloan Kettering Institute, and started people not having a crank. He made the electric starter for the Cadillac, started Delco, and he's a famous inventor. And Kettering said, "The world hates change, but it is the only thing that has brought progress." This is the experience that I'm having with this. Now, the self publication was for the reasons to avoid excessive pressure for multiple editions, unnecessary multiple editions, And the second thing was to sell the book for $25, which it's being sold for now because I control the copyright. And it's being sold on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, wherever, and the price stays at $25. And the way I was able to do this... Oh, sorry. Thank you. The way I'm able to do this is I learned through a colleague of mine on the faculty, Philip Maiman, who's in a financial engineering department, that there was... Because I was in touch with a lot of self-publishing places in Canada and the United States. And very, very often, what you hear from these people is that they'll self-publish the book. You have to order 1,000 copies. Essentially, you keep 1,000 copies in your basement or your garage. And then people write to you, and you have to collect the money and mail it. I just couldn't do that. I was ready to just retire and go to the farm and forget about the whole thing, because to do something like that is so onerous. Until Philip told me that Amazon.com had started a self-publishing arm called CreateSpace. And I got a hold of CreateSpace, and I recommend dealing with them highly because they really do what they say they're going to do. CreateSpace is connected to Amazon. Essentially, you send them a PDF file. It has to pass through their screening process. You know, they have to make sure the boundaries are okay. In other words, they don't care about what you're saying in the book, but they care about the technical details of how it's put together. And they're also willing to edit the book, to act as editors. And when they self-publish it, they'll keep an electronic version, and they'll print it on demand, which means that And it'll be sold through Amazon or by going through an outfit called Ingram. It becomes listed in all kinds of sites. The deal is actually quite good because this book is selling for $25. Of that $25, money goes here, money goes there with regard to their costs and stuff like that. But I actually make $8 a copy, which is more than the publishers would pay me if they were selling the book for $100, which is very interesting. But that's the way it works. So I highly recommend this route to self-publication. And CreateSpace is not paying me for this. They don't even know I'm here. I should have told them. Maybe I could have got something out of them or something. But at any rate, so that's the way it works. Now, with regard to this book, the editing of CreateSpace, they sent me a book that they had someone had written about Sherlock Holmes and how they edited it, and it looked quite nice. But this book was impossible for them because, you see, this book has hundreds of figures which have to, technical chemical structures which have to be placed in specific ways and annotated in certain ways, and it's a very complicated editing job. And so the editing job, I couldn't give that editing job to them. It was, as soon as they looked at it, they freaked out. You know, they just couldn't do it. And I'll tell you in a moment why the Kindle became impossible for them too, for that reason. I'll tell you about my own e-publishing aspect of this. And Stephen, am I taking 10 minutes? I'll be through. I'm almost finished. So this is a... So I had to hire my own editor, and you can't find anyone outside of the publishing industry, scientific publishing industry, who knows how to edit organic chemistry books. But I had a friend in New York who's a book editor, Bob Lascaro. All of this is written up on the website of the Canadian Science Writers Association, and working together with him, with his editing skills and my knowledge of what the book should look like, we made that cover, the covers that I showed you, and the inside of the book, which you can find, and so I ended up using CreateSpace for the publication, but not for the editing of the book. Now, the book is out now. It's sold. I had about 200 requests for people who wanted to look at it, which I've sent them copies of, because CreateSpace makes the copies available for $4 a piece to me. So that's pretty good. So I can buy copies and send them out. And 400 people have actually bought the thing, you know, which surprised me. So that's pretty nice. And CreateSpace also has a website where you can see who's the kind of money being used to buy the book. Is it a euro? Is it a pound? Is it a Canadian dollar, American dollar? It's I highly recommend that outfit to deal with. And so we'll see what's happening now. Because the terms have not started, came out in October, so we'll see if anybody picks the book up or if people are looking at it and it influences the way that they teach. Now, as far as the e-book is concerned, we tried to deal with the Kindle people at Amazon. It just was impossible. The book is too complicated, because the way Kindle works is you sort of flow through it. And this book has to have, the figures have to be connected to the text in very specific ways. It's just was not appropriate for Kindle. They wanted to do it, but they kept delaying. And finally, when you got to talk straight to them, they just said they just can't deal with a book like that. It's to us, you know, maybe someone else at Kindle. So we decided not to. And if I were going to do an iBook or whatever the Mac thing, I haven't done that yet. But I'm doing something else. That I'd like to tell you about, and no, that's finished now with this. I've hired a 17-year-old student near a piece of property I own in Greenwich, New York State, a little farm, an old abandoned farm that we're fixing up. He's a smart kid. He's the son of a farmer. Interested in going to medical school eventually. He's going into his senior year of high school. He's 17 years old. I spent $1,000 buying a little Epson projector like that, and this kind of stuff. And he is taking videos of me talking about the high points of each chapter. And we're going to put those videos on the web. I have them on the computer if someone wants to look at them later. We're going to put those on the web, and that will be the equivalent of an e-book. It'll be a live e-book. In other words, you can go on the web. You'll be able to go on the web when we're finished. We already have done chapter 1, 2, and 4, and keep going. And this is a kind of an e-book that I've never heard about before, where the author, me, actually stands in front of a whiteboard with one of these erasable paints and markers. The PowerPoint projections of certain of selected images go up, which are figures from the book, and I talk about them and write notes and stuff like that, and then when the next one goes on, I erase that and then do that again, going through all 12 chapters, and then we're going to make that available on the web or in little discs. So that is a kind of an e-book, but not exactly. And that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
And next we have Stephen Strauss speaking.
So I'm at a different stage than Mark in working on actually on a couple of books. But I'm approaching this from the perspective of I wanted to write these books not as Mark has described it, basically as a print book, that then you say, having turned it out as a print book, then turn it into an e-book, which is a kind of a replication of the print book. So my notion was that I wanted to write a book where the presupposition is this is an e-book. And if it gets printed out, maybe it won't get printed out. It'll have to be, it'll be different if that would happen. And I do this in part looking at, let's say, trends taking place in the book publishing industry. That is to say, there was an estimate 2 days ago that by 2017 in the United States, e-books will have superseded print books in terms of print revenue. But also with the presupposition that how it is that people are learning and understanding things in an internet-based age is based on being able to do the kinds of things you can do electronically and you can't do in print. So with this in mind, I'm going to talk to you about a couple of projects that I'm working on. So, all right. There is with this issue, so keep going, Peter. Okay. The first question that I find myself facing in doing this is that I know I can hyperlink to other places and to additional information. It seems to me, I know when I read stuff, I really want to be able to go to different places and see other stuff besides what the author has presented. What you have in terms of medium is if you look at print, print is essentially, author-owned. So the author says, I think you should know this and this and this, and this is the order in which you should learn this and this and this and this. In the internet world, in the e-publishing world, there is a more of a sense of, like, I kind of want to learn based on how I want to learn. I want to make the order of things. I want to be able to look at other stuff. So what you see is, off the top, hyperlinks. The question is, what do you hyperlink, and how many hyperlinks do you do, and what does this do to the narrative flow? Maybe another hyperlink. Okay. So as I'm saying, this is the presumption, that in the future this will be expected. I dare say that I think that all textbooks will be like this. Not only will be like this, but soon will be like this. The question is, so then how do you do this? What are the rules? So, Peter? So, I say, okay. So, one of the books I'm working on is a kid's book. A kid's book with a science component to it. So it's about, the narrative is about a boy and his grandmother going through a place called Riverdale Farm. Riverdale Farm is actually a real urban farm 3 blocks from my house. Part of the reason I'm interested in writing this book is because they're having funding issues. And I thought, geez, if I could write something that people would buy and I could donate some of the money from the book to the farm, that would be a good civic act. So the conceit of the book, and we'll see it in a second, is that the boy and his grandmother are walking through the farm. And the grandmother says, I think to the boy, I think you're a boy genius. And the boy says, we can click and actually. So they're walking through the farm now. And the boy genius, and the boy says, what's that? But before we get there, so we've got a picture of going into the farm, but, Peter, can you click on the Riverdale farm? So, because it's a real place, it seems to me, who people who don't know about it say, what's Riverdale for? Well, lo and behold, there's a Wikipedia entry for Riverdale for. So you go and you can take a look and you can see kind of descriptions of the closure issues, and you can see it used to be the zoo in Toronto. So if you go there, you end up with things that the former gorilla building is still there, not used for gorillas because the gorillas were all moved. So the kids in Riverdale Farm, they get to see this. I'm describing, so next slide. So they pass through, thing says washrooms. The grandmother says, I wonder what the boy genius will ask me today. Click, boy genius. So we get to find out boy geniuses in the world. Click back. And the grandmother says, a boy genius is someone who asks questions that nobody would suspect should be asked before they were. So that's a little too complicated maybe, but he goes, huh? Oops. So one of the things is they're walking through, they come across a cat which looks like it's trying to get a drink for itself out of a drinking fountain. So back. Yeah. Down, next page. So he looks, and there it is, looking like it's waiting for some person to push the button so it could drink. And so then he asks his grandmother, are there cat and dog geniuses too? So, okay. We don't have to look at all of this, so. Oops. That doesn't look good. Oh. Okay. So here we have a story about this dog called Chaser who broke the world's record for the largest human vocabulary understood by a dog. He can understand 1,000 words, et cetera, et cetera. There are, and the cat geniuses go back. Cat geniuses are more. Well, this is actually a question, you know. So go to the cat geniuses. Yes, you do, Peter. Even though you don't like cats. Okay. Oops. Oops. Okay. Go to cat. Okay. So we have a cat learning how to clean itself using a human cleaning device, making the thing go. Okay, you can get. So I'm saying, okay. So she likes what he says and says, okay, let's go and I'll buy you some ice cream. You can see the questions. So that immediately rise. So you go off somewhere else. You're looking at something else. Are you going to come back? Are you going to look at the cat and say, well, gee, that was interesting. I wonder if there are more videos of cats. I think I want to go off and see, you know, more cat stuff. The question of how do you ensure the toing and froing, the backing and forth thing, I'm not sure I've figured out yet. Also, when you link to a site, a la, you know, that was indicated, you say, well, geez, there's all this other stuff on the site. I'm not sure that the parents are going to want to link to that site. How do I do this then? how do I do a link up in which I'm doing a hyperlink, but it's only to what I want to hyperlink, and it doesn't have to do with the business model, let's say, of the site, the site that I link to. I'm not sure. I mean, I look at this and I say, well, I can see I can do it. I can see, again, I guess I would argue that there's going to be a presumption on the part of readers in the future that this sort of thing is going to be happen. How do I do it sensibly? How do I do enough and not too much? How do I limit stuff? I won't say this is easy, but it's a different kind of issue that I'm facing in the next book. So, had the ice cream, go ahead, so. We just keep going. Yeah. And there it is, I'm not sure. Keep going, next. Okay. So these are the kinds of questions that you ask. How many enough is enough? How many is too many? What about copywriting? I pull these sorts of things off of freely available on the internet. Well, is someone going to say that? I took a picture of the cat in the fountain. You know, you owe me for this. Etc. So we've talked about this. Again, I mean, it seems to me it's one of these things where if you're teaching a writing program where you're doing print, we actually know what the rules are. We actually know when it's convincing and not convincing. We know sort of what we should do and not do. When you get into a world in which you are doing an electronic publishing and you're doing hyperlinking, I guess it's terra incognita in a way. I'll give you another example. Go to the next. Okay. So I'm working on an adult science book. This is it flows from this. I've been working on this for like more than a decade now. And it's one that it's been at traditional publishers and up and down and yes and no and whatever. And I've decided I want to self-publish it myself for several reasons. The story is, go to the next, about this woman, Clara Davis, who between 1926 and 1931 conducted an experiment allowing, go to the next one, so allowing newly weaned infants, so they're quite literally taken from their mother's breasts and put into what we would call today a child self-selection orphanage. And the conceit was that maybe humans have something called a wisdom of the body. That is to say that our appetites reflect the body's understanding of what we should do in terms of eating, in the same kind of way that when it's hot, we sweat, when we run, our heart beats faster. So that there are natural mechanisms within the body that allow us to allow it to do the right thing. So the notion is, if we let these children, who actually don't know what food is, because their only experience has been with breast milk, if we present before them upwards of 34 different things served over the course of a day, we let them eat exactly what they want and how much they want, will they choose wisely? So the kids who were in the experiment the longest were in for 4.9 years. Every single thing they ate at every single meal over that period of time was weighed, measured, listed. They were weighed, measured, listed. All kinds of information came from them. It's an experiment, amongst other things, in which we can quantify exactly how much food a baby dribbles away when learning to feed itself. So all of the mess on the floor of babies feeding themselves, she can tell you exactly how much. Nobody ate the same. It looks like, at least from this study, there is no standard human diet. Everyone eats in their own way. You've got carnivores, you've got vegetarians, you've got in between, but not just that. At the beginning of every day, you don't know what the child's going to eat. Let's see the next one. So you can have what they call JAGS, where the kid suddenly eats 10 eggs in a day and then doesn't eat eggs for a month after. You end up with this, you know, this toing and froing in the child, which is unpredictable. So in writing this as an e-book, there are issues that I've been trying to deal with. Hyperlinking is there, but it's kind of in a different context. So what I want is, because it seems to me, again, it's part of what's happening in the modern world, you don't want to go to footnotes. Footnotes are, in a traditional book, basically a way of saying, look, you know, you could go here if you want, but I know no one's going to go there. No one's going to go, oh, page 286 of this book that they don't have easy access to and look up the reference. What you can do is, in an electronic format, you can link directly to the paper. And I'm interested in people being able to link directly to the paper, not just to see where she said it, but to see what I've left out, to see the context other than me, the author, in writing the book, to see the context in which she wrote her papers. Her papers are, she wrote about 16 papers on this. So, go ahead, click. Like I say, it should be easy. She died in 1959. The last experiment, the last paper was in 39. In Canada, copyright law says everything a person wrote becomes public domain 50 years after their death. But I can't do it. Why? Keep going. Okay. So, Sonny Bono and Mickey Mouse. I don't know if that means anything to most people here. Peter's head is nodding. So, and Sherlock, yeah. Well, so, what happened is, the United States passed a completely different copyright law than anyone else, anywhere else in the world. So now it takes, the traditional copyright law was 50 years after death, and Canada's not alone. Sometimes it's 70 years, but it's around that. Lobbying by the Disney people, pushed by Sonny Bono, who was then a congressman from California, led to, it's 120 years after death, which means I can't freely link to the Davis papers if, in fact, someone is going to be buying this in the United States. If they were buying it in Canada, I could link, and that would be fine in terms of Canadian law. Since I can't say to people, okay, there's a different U.S. version in which you're not going to be able to see what it is, how it is that I've written this book in some way. You're not going to be able to see the context, which means, click. I either have to produce a separate e-edition to be sold only in Canada and not the United States, or I don't, and don't include the tie-ins with the Davis book. I find this, well, they say in Portuguese, uma bagunça, which is a prickly pear. I find this not just, you know, difficult. I am fundamentally irritated and angry at this. Because the reality is that there have been lots of things that have been screwed up in the interpretation of this research. And they have been screwed up not insignificantly because people couldn't go to the original papers. They would quote what someone said about something, and it was wrong. They misrepresented the things. And when they corrected it, they would miscorrect the things because they hadn't seen the other things that they hadn't seen the other thing that that had been written or she had written about things. And we're talking about research that is, say, 70 years old, 75, 80 years old, in obscure publications that if you don't have access to a university library, you can't get. I've been talking to the publishers, saying, look, this is stupid. These papers, can I put it on your website and I will link to your website? Well, no, because their business model is, this is our publication. You can, if people want it, they can send us $35. and we will. They can then have these papers. It's crazy. It's crazy because I guess as I'm saying to you, I want to write this book like an ebook. I can't do it if I am not allowed to do these kind of links so people can actually look at what I'm talking about. Next. So. Oh, ooh, quick. All right. Really good things. There are now hundreds, thousands of references to this research on the internet. What I'm going to do is, when I get this, I've got 90,000 words, so we're not talking about nothing there. When I get it ready, I'm going to send notes to these people, to their blogs, to their websites, if they publish books, telling them that this book exists. I can do that. I can sell the books myself. To people who I know are interested in it. They're not just anybody, but they're people who have evinced interest, which means I can get around the blockage of a bookstore and the publisher's not sending out whatever. The writer and the publisher can link up. But there can be problems between coming writer, publisher, and bookstore because how much do I charge for the book? So we heard Mark was describing how little, you know, he'd have to do a $100 book in order for him to make what he's making from this self-published book. I mean, traditionally what happened is the price of the book included the cost of the editors and printing and distribution and the bookstore stuff. The amount that the writer got, if the writer got, I don't know, got 10%, you know, 15% would be a lot. That would be a lot, because all of the middlemen are getting paid. The question is, if you charge less for it, click, do we find ourselves in this situation where we have expressed a diminution in the value of it? Because if you charge 99 cents for a book, it's the same as the price of, you know, candy bars or something. A book is not just the price is not just the cost of the book, it's the valuation of the book. What's the range between what I think the book is worth and between this diminution in the elimination of the middlemen that created intrinsic prices? So how much is enough and not too much? I don't know. I'm not sure. If you look at pricing on the internet, it's really quite interesting for electronic books. People are all over the place. The market's going to tell me soon. So I finish with, you know, Marshall McLuhan famously, oops, it's not there, the medium is the message. I say, my addition to this, that if you don't know what the message is, until you know what the medium can do. And that's actually what's exciting about e-publishing. We're actually learning what the medium can do, and that is telling us what its message is going to be. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Stephen and Dr. Green for speaking. If I could ask the two of you to come up to the front, please, for the question and answer session. So again, just to reiterate what's going on, this is going to be recorded for our webinar on the Canadian Science Writers Association website. There is a microphone that's right there in the center of the room. Beside the microphone, near the lady in the green shirt, there is a stack of consent forms that you will need to sign if you're interested in sending us a question, which we certainly hope you will. So can you please go up and turn and ask your questions? Yep. Because your name and your image and your voice are going to be recorded onto this webinar, we need to have your permission to do that. Pardon me? Not sure. You got another one that goes there. There's another wireless mic that's going throughout the audience.
Yeah, but my question is, how much was that? How much did you pay
in the end, that cost me $8,000.
$8,000 plus the $3,000.
Because it was an extremely, we wanted to make a really beautiful book.
Uh-huh.
And I have a copy of the book here.
No, I saw that. So the interesting fact is the costs for you of this book were $11,000.
So far.
So a little bit more,
actually. Even more than that, because I also paid someone to make the figures. The book has cost me now $17,000.
$17,000, and so far.
400 copies.
Where you get $8.
$3,200 back, so far.
You're still hopeful.
No, because I wanted to, I'll tell you something. I'm a research scientist fundamentally. And I've published many papers, as you see, as you mentioned, many of them are referenced in the literature. I never looked at this book as a money-making device. I always looked at it as a publication in a scientific journal. If I published an article in the Journal of the American Chemical Society or the Canadian Journal of Chemistry or other high-ranked places, it was a message to the community of scientists that there's a new idea out there. Here's an idea I have. So I don't care if I ever make the money back. I'm more interested in the idea being gotten out there that you can teach science in this particular way. But my wife is convinced that we will get it and that it will happen. And that's one of the reasons that I'm doing this thing with this kid from down the road. In other words, it's going to be on the web with me talking about it.
So you ended on a point about being frustrated with copyright, and
yeah.
I am too. Even though I get a check from them every year, the what is it called, Access Copyright.
Right.
I hate what they're doing. In particular, with education, like my book is actually used in schools,
right.
And they want schools to pay an arm and a leg,
yeah.
You know, et cetera, et cetera. I was wondering, as president of the CSWA, can we do something and take a stand on changing copyright laws?
We can. It's not that the view I've presented here is unknown in the wider world, particularly in terms of, you know, scientific, science-related publications where you're looking at articles. I always wonder, what do we get out of it? We take a stand, we don't like this. We can join up with organizations. There really has been the American stuff. There was actually much resistance to the Sonny Bono Mickey Mouse law. The reason why Mickey Mouse's copyright was coming to an end, and so that's why one put in place to ensure that Disney would have, you know, tons of money flowing in forever. So I don't know. I mean, there is. I mean, the whole open access question is actually really, you know, in terms of scientific publications, really interesting. I think there's a difference between a creative act a la, let's say, a novel or maybe even, you know, the Mickey Mouse kind of thing, and writing a science book. I want people to know what this was about, what this woman found and didn't find, and I wanted in this sort of, because in fact the issue is part of the continuing discussion about this. When I say there's lots of people who write about this, it's because what she found remains of interest. So,
Stephen, I didn't quite follow. Even if you identify people who have commented on in their blogs or elsewhere on Davis, and you, they're in the United States, you can't send them the book, can you?
Well, if I wrote the book in which, because I'm going to do it, it'll be an electronic thing, so they would download it themselves. If, in fact, I wrote the book as I want to write the book, where you can go and it's not just, you know, this footnote, but in fact click on this and you get to go exactly in the paper where it is that this is being quoted, and you can then look, if you want, you can look and see the other stuff that's around that. If they would buy the book in the United States, I would be in violation of U.S. copyright laws. So I could write a book like this in this country and some significant number of other countries in the world, but I can't have sort of two books, because in fact what I've been trying to say, my presumption is I want this to be intrinsic in the book. I want the ability to see what I'm talking about. I want a kind of a diminution in the authority of the author to just say, this is what's there, this is what I think you should know. I want people to actually get to, if they want, maybe they don't want, they can see for themselves, and it doesn't work both ways.
Dr. Green, you made mention of the fact that Amazon... Okay.
Mark,
you made mention of the fact that Amazon had another service which they offered, which would spread the word about this. I can't remember the name, Image or...
Ingram.
I don't know if you
it's
used
it. It's
not
Amazon, it's Ingram. Ingram is
it's not part of Amazon.
No, it's a book listing service that when you first put the book on, people can only buy it on Amazon. But using Ingram, which we have done, you can... buy it from Barnes & Noble and all kinds of booksellers all over the world. And create whatever people order, the book creates space, prints it on demand. And I'm watching every day as the sales go on. And that's the way it happens. But I'm really having a lot of fun right now with this young fellow from down the road because we're making an e-book. But it's not an e-book, it's me talking, it's me going through this book. And that I think is an ebook that I never heard of before, where the author essentially is reading the book. Except I'm not reading the book; I'm explaining about it.
This is a question, sort of, for both of you, but I'm going to address it for Stephen. But feel free to answer too, Mark. Stephen, when you're speaking about the medium is the message. And the issues that not being able to understand what the medium can do right now. I'm wondering how much of that is actually the legislative framework and not actually the medium. And if you were to take the framework out of it, what do you think the medium could do ultimately? And what it's being blocked right now, so I guess what's the potential is my question.
Well, I guess when I say the medium issue is also related to the first, the children's... How many hyperlinks do I include? How do I get back and forth between the hyperlinks? In terms of, you know, look, there are so many hyperlinks here that I stopped reading the book at page 8, you know. Oh, look, I really wanted this to be hyperlinked and you didn't do it. You know, it really irritates me. Why didn't you do that? There has got to be, I would think, through experience probably more than anything else, we'll figure this out. You know, we'll figure this sort of thing out. We'll figure, because we don't, I didn't maybe emphasize it enough. I think people are starting to read differently. And they're starting to read differently because the presumption of an electronic book is that you'll be able to see stuff, go to stuff that you can in a print book. And I'll give you two tangential examples. One is I'm reading an autobiography of Saul Steinberg, who was an illustrator, artist, did New Yorker covers. He's famous for this. So it's a very thick book. It's like this. And it includes descriptions of covers, works that he did. The number of actual pictures that you get in the book are, they're not, first of all, they're not located where they're located in the book. It doesn't sort of the discussion of this, you know, followed by a picture, because would they have to have special paper to print the pictures on to give it, you know, high gloss or whatever. So it's one of these things. You've had this experience, you know, 150 pages into the book, then there's the list of pictures. You look at it and say, oh geez, where was that one from? I can't remember. I know they were talking about that, but I don't know where it is. I keep looking at stuff, and I say, I want to see it, you know, because what we've got is, you know, it's the picture worth 1,000 words. Well, you often have 1,000 words doesn't equal a picture. I want to see it. It's a picture. It's visual. I can't do it because it's a print book, because it's this thick, because it costs, you know, millions of dollars. And I'm saying, but no, that's how it used to be. That was the problem you faced with the print book medium. I don't want to face that anymore because I know we can get around that. Because, you know, we do get around that. The other sort of tangential thing, I've just written an article in which, again, there was all kinds of visual elements in it.
and I'm writing it, and I realize I don't want to tell you about this. I want you to see this. What that does is it means either the article has to go on the internet, or it has to get to be a lot longer. So I got in this big discussion with the editors. Look, let me show you. Look, you get to see what I'm talking about. You get to see, you know, and they say, well, but we only have, you know, this amount of printed space. And so we can't do that. So if you look at the piece, you've got a visual article where there's nothing to see. You know, blow my head out. But that's the way to, the new media, you know, that's not the case. You don't have, these are not issues. You can have as many pictures, images as you want, as links as you want. The question is, how much is enough? How much is too many? When do you end up with a kind of a different kind of confusion? When do you have to, let us say, edit linkages? You know, so.
I think with your with the children's book, presumably the chapters are going to be very short,
yes,
very
yeah.
snappy.
Yeah.
I think at the moment, you know, you've got too many hyperlinks.
I think you're probably right.
And you're going to interrupt your reading flow, and especially if you're linking a kid to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
But what about just doing the links at the bottom of each chapter, like useful links, and the child reader could just pick and choose?
Maybe. I mean, because, you know, maybe you're right, but I say I don't know what the language of doing this is. Because if you look at how the hyperlinks are done in a variety of formats, sometimes it can be like that, but often it is, if you read on news stories often, you know, about so-and-so, hyperlink, and you can go see about, you know, about the so-and-so and the thing. I'm working on it, because what you say is actually what keeps going through my mind. One of the other chapters is about the boy goes with his grandmother, and they're seeing cows, and there's a family there. And the father says to the daughter, la vache mugle, which means the cow moves. And the little girl says, mugle, 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 at the cows. And the little boy asks his grandmother, what's they saying? And the grandmother speaks French, and she says that she's saying the cow moves. The little boy says, oh, that's interesting. And then he goes back home, and he goes online, and he goes to Google Translate, and he puts in moo, and he puts in all the different languages that you can translate moo into, in the world, you know, at least Google Translate world. And then he comes back, he's with his grandmother the next time, and they're looking at the cows, and he says, there's something I don't understand. He says, I only speak one language, and you speak two languages. But look, the cows can speak all these different languages. How come the cows are so much smarter than we are? Anyhow, but I'd like actually the kid to be able to go and look at Google Translate.
It'd be great if he can actually get the sound of the cow moving too.
Well, there was a meow thing there. I'm doing the same thing because I'm sort of saying you're going to farms, you're saying the cow's moving. Don't you want to hear, you know, don't you want to hear the sound of things? Again, I'm not, it's one of these things because I look at it and say, is that too much? Is that, you know, anyhow.
Stephen, I think it's very interesting what you're trying to do, but I keep thinking that maybe you're thinking about more of a web page instead of an e-book, because then you have also the complication of the different supports you may have. You can have a Kindle that has black and white screen and no access to internet, so you can click on the hyperlink to YouTube and
right.
You have nothing.
Yeah.
So you have I don't know how many configurations of stuff you can have.
Yeah.
And then how you solve it to create just one thing.
I agree. It's what I'm trying to express here. I look at stuff, you know, stuff like that, and I say, well, what's the right way to go? In a kind of way, it's interesting, because if you're, I don't know if there are actually editors for books, ebook editors, that for whom this kind of question is actually, you sort of say, tell me your experience, tell me what works, explain what's enough and too many. Is there, do you only link to articles of this length or to videos of this length? Is there, do you find yourself, you know, in terms of moving, you know, back and forth? The reason why I'm doing this, you know, I've been expressing this. I think this is how things are going to work. I think kids' books are going to be ebooks. I think all kind of academic research books are going to be ebooks, in part because we didn't talk about this. You want to do keyword searches. There's nothing that drives me crazier about a book that I want to find out about this. And it's a print book, and well, maybe it's in the index, but probably not. And I can't find out about that because, or I remember it was somewhere before, but I can't remember what page. You know, what you get is you get the instant relocation of your reading. I think that, I guess I don't know, but this is why I was, presenting on. I think that that's what people are going to expect. The question of all that you're describing, though, is how should it look and the interference between looking like this. Yeah. Yeah.
I just wanted to say I think that actually you hit on it, but it isn't necessarily what people are going to expect. This is how my grandchildren are learning right now. I have a 4-year-old that's learning algebra on a program that's a game. Even you don't realize it's algebra until you sit down and you're doing it. For babies, you have books that here's the train and you push the button and it toots. Here's a
right.
It shows you the color red.
Right.
That is how young children are learning right now. This is the way we need to go.
Yeah. And part of what you're seeing here is me sort of saying, if I'm going to be teaching people about or talking to people about scientific issues, how do I, how do I do it? Or maybe we're just going to experiment with this, and at some point, that was really good, and we'll actually look and deconstruct it and say, what is it that made it good? But the question of not knowing what the message is if you don't understand the medium, I think, that just keeps leaping up.
In reference to Mark, I was going to say that in Amazon and in Kindle, when you actually are loading up your book, you do load up the pictures in PDF separately from your print, and when a person actually looks at it, it puts it back together at Amazon for you. So I just wrote a manual, a learning manual. You do the snippet, you do it in PDF, and you insert them as pictures.
Maybe we should give Amazon another shot at the Kindle of this thing. They only wanted $450 to do it. They kept delaying and delaying and delaying. See, I'm really into this other idea now, which is that I'm going to lecture about the book online. In other words, I have it here. I can show it to you afterwards if you like. A couple
of
chapters.
Are you going on YouTube under how-to and doing each chapter as a how-to?
No, I'm just doing it on the computer and saving it on.
I would suggest you go to YouTube and go under how-to every chapter.
Well, my wife is a filmmaker, and she puts her work called the Louise Log on YouTube, and so she's an expert at that stuff, and so I'm depending on her. And I asked her on the phone last night, Annie, she said, there's nothing I know better. And she's even suggesting that we use Vimeo to put those things on. But I'm really excited about that because someone who buys that book, already the answers to all the problems are free on the web. I have a website where they're free. And I'm going to put all that stuff for free. So someone who buys the book can hear me talking about it and then look at the book. So to me that goes beyond Kindle and beyond iBooks and eBooks. It's you actually get the author of the textbook and you see that person talking about what's in the book online. And if you get tired, the person who's the student or whoever's looking at it, you can stop. If you didn't understand something, you can go back. This is called flipped teaching. It's the newest thing in academics now. It would be interesting to write about flipped teaching. In other words, instead of my going in, which I've done historically, and lecture for 3 hours, twice a week or three times a week, instead the kids in the class look at the stuff on their electronic devices in whatever time they want, reversing it, stopping, starting, doing whatever they want. Then when they come into class where I would normally be talking about this, I'll be there to answer their questions or do problems with them and stuff like that. And academic teaching is moving in that direction. But, you know, I wanted to talk to Stephen about something. You know, if you look up a paper in the literature and online in Science Magazine or some other, any journal, you always have the option of doing exactly what you're doing. If I pull up a scientific paper, there's always an option, and you don't pay anything extra for it. Maybe my library, the university library.
You can do it. Sorry. If, you know, if in fact you have access to a university library, and if that library actually has access to, sometimes it's actually kind of difficult if it's old publications, because, but that's, I'm not writing the book for people who have access.
It shows the success of what you're doing. The scientific literature appreciates the ability to do what you're trying to do.
Well, this is the kind of presumption almost of looking. Though it is interesting, I was chatting with a guy who's editing books for the Oxford Press. One of the things that they're doing now in terms of doing ebooks is they're eliminating OPSIT and IBID and all of those kind of terms that were used to say, look, you know, I've already mentioned this. And the reason why is because they assume on an ebook that actually people, you know, may want to actually go to the actual thing. They don't want to have an OPSIT, they want the original reference, and also it doesn't make any difference. It's not going to make the book, you know, significantly longer. I mean, when I can with the Clara Davis book, I'm doing hyperlinks to, you know, to all kinds of stuff. It's just, one thing I mentioned this, but I really should emphasize it. The ability to reach out to people who you know are interested in something is a big deal for an author. Because if you publish books, and I've published books, and they go to a bookstore, and they went to a bookstore, and they were hidden in some little corner somewhere, and people had to kind of know about it, or you'd hope, like, well, maybe there'll be a review of this, maybe someone will hear about it. But it was lost in the, you know, the massive kind of jungle of books in a bookstore. And the book couldn't leap out and say to people, look, I can tell you're interested in this, this, and this. People had to chance upon it. The ability of an author to single out people who they know are interested in what they're doing seems to me is going to be a big deal in the future. It's not all books. It's not all things that will be allow this. But in some cases, you'll be able to circumvent the essential roadblock of a bookstore. A bookstore was not a very efficient way of selling books, but it was the only way we had. So you had, I don't know, however many thousands of, you know, and you didn't, if yours wasn't there, well, where's it going to be, and, you know, et cetera. You can now go online and, you know, order things. But that's not very good either, because you don't really know what's there. You know, you kind of, you know, so anyhow.
I think we have time for one more question, if anybody's interested. We're all done? Oh, wait, we got one more. Okay.
Yeah, sure. This is for Dr. Green. Dr. Green, I'm just curious. Mark. have you done any kind of research, or has anybody done any studying around your concept or your premise to see if it actually does work in terms of helping students capture organic chemistry concepts? And I ask that as a relatively mediocre organic chemistry student back in the day.
I'm actually using the approach for my classes, and these kids on the cover were actually students in the class, mm-hmm. And so I only have anecdotal information. It's very, very difficult. You know, there are people now out in the academic world, and there's whole divisions of the National Science Foundation of the United States dedicated to testing educational concepts, mm-hmm. And is this working or is this not working, and they devise all kinds of questionnaires to ask students and all kinds of clever meta this and who knows what. And I'm sorry to say, I don't think much of that stuff. But I think that you get in there and you teach. And so far, what I see is excitement among the students because of the relevance of it. In other words, when you were learning about carbocations, remember that a little bit? Okay, well, were you aware of the fact that the petroleum industry uses that chemical entity to make high-octane fuel, and that your body uses that chemical entity to make steroids? You know, that it's that kind of stuff, see? And the book is full of that context. And what I'm seeing is that the kids love it, but what I'm also seeing is hate. There's a lot of objection out there to this, and that German reviewer was not alone, and the Nature review, there's conflict about this right now, and the conflict, in my opinion, comes from emotion. It comes from a resistance to change, and that is something that I'm seeing. And time will tell.
Okay, thank you very much. So that concludes the session. So if I would just ask the speakers to remain behind for a moment, we have a small gift, sort of a token of our appreciation for your time today. So I'll direct you as to what's happening next. There's going to be a networking break right now in the McGill Faculty Club, this building, the main lounge and the ground floor. And then at 3:30, we have two breakout sessions. The first one is on smart machines, and that will be on the third floor in the old McGill room. The second one is going to be on blogging, and that will be on the Heritage Room on the ground floor. Thank you again.